Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So I went and looked up that sutta that I referenced last night, and it's a great sutta. Anybody who wants to keep track of it, Anguttara 8, number 30, Anuruddha is in the forest and practicing and has this idea of these seven sort of thoughts, thought trends of a great being. and then, as I said, the Buddha added on the last one of non-complication. So these eight thoughts of a great being are to be, say, this Dhamma is for, because what Anuruddha is contemplating is sort of, you know, what accords with Dhamma, what accords with the Buddha's teaching, what accords with the practice, and this Dhamma is for one with few wishes, not for one with many wishes. That's how Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it. Ajahn Jaff translates it as this Dhamma is for one who is modest, not for one who is self-aggrandizing. Second quality, or second thought, is this Dhamma is for one who is content, not for one who is discontent. And third one is this Dhamma is for one who delights in solitude, not for one who delights in company, delights in entanglement. Fourth quality is this Dhamma is for one who is energetic, not for one who is lazy. Fifth quality is this Dhamma is for one with well-established mindfulness, not for one whose mindfulness is muddled. The sixth is this Dhamma is for one who is concentrated, not for one who is unconcentrated, or for one who is centered, not for one who is uncentered. Sixth is this Dhamma is for one who is wise, not for one who is unwise, or say, alternate translation of Ajahn Jeff, one for one with discernment, not with one without discernment. And then the last one is this Dhamma is for one who delights in non-complication, not for one who delights in complication. And Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it as this Dhamma is for one who delights in non-proliferation, not for one who delights in proliferation. Ajahn Jaff translates it as this Dhamma is for one who delights in non-objectification, not for one who delights in objectification. So there's different nuances, but those are the thought trends, ways of directing the mind that will help one accord with Dhamma. And then in the sutta, the Buddha says, for one who thinks he's in that way, establishes that pattern, then it's normal, it's to be expected that, that one would dwell peacefully, or that one would realize with ease the states of well-being, of happiness, and of the say subtle states of meditation and insight. That's just sort of is a natural result, and then also that as one does that, then even if one lives simply, then one dwells in happiness constantly. So it's a quite a beautiful sutta, and then Anuruddha takes the Buddha advised Anuruddha to stay in the forest in the area that he was residing at that time, and so that Anuruddha did that, stayed the rains retreat. By the end of the rains retreat, he had realized path and fruit, so he'd realized arahantship. It's a beautiful sutta, but it also, the Buddha goes on to explain what the what these different thoughts are, you know, what's their context, and the particularly the first one, it makes it a bit more clear why, say, Ajahn Jeff translates it for one who is modest, not for one who is self-aggrandizing, because the and the way that Bhikkhu Bodhi translates of one with few wishes, not with one with many wishes, and that that the, say the practitioner doesn't have the thought of let people know me as one who is modest. Let people know me as one who is content. Let people know me. Let people know me as one who is delights in solitude. So that there's a modesty there that is a foundation. Sort of, I think Ajahn Jeff's way of translating illustrates the kind of the meaning behind it. And of course, the quality and the thought of contentment, this dhamma is for one who is content. Learning for the practitioner is being content with the, in particular as monastics, and being content with the robes, alms food, lodging, and medicines that are available, that being one who is content with what is offered, and delighting in solitude, not delighting, being one who doesn't delight in company of others or in the in entanglement. And it's quite interesting when the Buddha explains it, because he says that for one who is dwelling in solitude and they're dwelling in solitude, practicing diligently, and then people come to see him and meet with him, bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, laymen, laywomen, kings, king's ministers, practitioners of, wanderers of other religious sects, all these people coming. but it engages in appropriate conversation and doesn't get entangled. So it isn't as if, okay, delighting in solitude, I can't see anybody anymore, can't have any contact, get out of my face, I'm not going to have to, and to some extent, so, I delight in solitude, I won't have to deal with people again. So I'll be a practitioner. But the Buddha is more so, no, there's appropriate relationships. We're just really learning boundaries. Yeah. When it's time to be quiet, to know how to be quiet. When it's not, when it's time to engage, then engaging appropriately with sort of Dhamma as the basis. So, being one who is energetic. The Dhamma is for one who is energetic, not for one who is lazy. When the Buddha defines what is one who is energetic, it's energetic in the relinquishing of unwholesome Dhammas and energetic in the bringing into being of wholesome Dhammas. So it's like it's much more defined by the quality of mind as opposed to say one who is energetic is defined by how much frenetic activity they can get involved in. So that sense of paying attention to the quality of the mind. One who's one with clear mindfulness is one who is alert, attentive, able to recollect what was done and said in the past. And I don't know where that leaves me. This seems to be leaking out in many places. I sort of remember things. It's interesting that that's how the Buddha defines it. There's this clarity, attentiveness, alertness, and it results in, or is quantified by, that sense of being able to bring to mind what one has said and done. And this Dhamma being for one who is concentrated or centered, it comes back to the standard definition of the four jhanas. And for one who is wise, and not for one who is unwise, or for one who has discernment, wisdom or discernment, the Buddha defines it as having knowledge of the arising and passing away of phenomena, which is noble. So that it isn't, because sometimes we think, there's got to be some piece of esoteric knowledge that will really make me wise, but it's much more about seeing and recognizing, understanding the nature of phenomena, whether it's external, internal, belonging to the world, belonging to oneself, coarse or refined, whatever. Arises and it ceases. The knowledge of impermanence, inconstancy. And for one who delights in non-proliferation or non-objectification or non-complication, it's the willingness to incline to that which is peaceful. So that's it's a beautiful description. So that these are qualities that we all can recollect, bring to mind, encourage ourselves in. That's not, say, none of it is far away or distant or impossible for any of us. Those definitions are, and that encouragement are really, on a certain level, quite ordinary. But it's the bringing it to mind, the recollecting of it, the encouraging of ourselves in that directing of thought, directing of attention in those ways. And it's also because sometimes we, you know, we approach meditation as a technical problem. My mind is unpeaceful, or my mind is agitated. Therefore, I must have the wrong technique. I have to find the right tool, the right. If I could just tweak the methodology, then my mind would all of a sudden become really peaceful and clear, and I'd be just zapped with brilliant insight. And but it's much more, how do you say, systemic, that which we need to cultivate, like really cultivating the systems of how we live, how we interact with the world, how we perceive ourselves, what we bring to mind, what our mind inclines towards, so that these qualities of contentment, of energy, of composure, the willingness to step back from complication. These are things that have a really profound impact on our being. So to take an interest in that, and in particular, say in this retreat, it's billed as a monastic retreat, and so that. Picking up on some of the values and the ways of how the how our life, our lifestyle, or how our way of practicing is supporting our meditation practice, so that having a routine where we say the monastic rhythm of life. If many of you here have been to Bhayagiri or been to other monasteries, and see that there's a there tends to be a rhythm and a routine that is followed, and to picking that up and just putting one's attention and effort into that. And you find that it has an effect in the sense of, it creates a container. So like as I talked about last night of the precepts, it creates a container. The rhythm of the practice schedule. And especially as we get settled, I don't expect everybody to be keeping the schedule absolutely, perfectly, exactly how I'm doing. But the, you know, to really put one's attention onto it, how to keep that rhythm going. And because for some people might feel that doing more walking meditation is more helpful for mindfulness and the settling of the mind. Some people might prefer to do more sitting meditation, and that and which is to me is fine. You know, if one wants to duck out during a sitting period, do more walking, or wants to stay in during a walking period and continue sitting, you know, that's absolutely fine. But I think it's a part of it that when I say you're paying attention to the schedule, this one is the getting a rhythm and a momentum going for the practice. You'll find that rhythm, that momentum, is what really helps the mind to settle. Let's see, like the image that Ajahn Chah used to use of the like putting maintaining a steadiness in the practice. It's like in the old days when you living in the countryside in Thailand, and you want to start a fire, you don't have a lighter, you don't have matches, but you can take the bamboo sticks and you can rub them, and it'll create a fire. It's slow, definitely slower. Although I saw Armand start a fire real quick with a little bow drill and his gear for starting fires without the say modern technology. But it doesn't work if you sort of just throw yourself at it for a little bit and then take a break. Wow, it's tiring out. You have to, and then keep on, come back and do it a bit later, and so, and then you can't make fire like this. But just doing it, keeping at it in a steady, even way, and you can start a fire with really rudimentary materials. And in the same way, our own minds are pretty rudimentary, but we can cultivate clarity and peace and discernment and understanding if we're steady at it, if we're consistent with it. So just the aspects of contentment, being in from us as living in a monastery, learning how to be content with what has been offered, that's when we very first went to live at Abhayagiri, made a real strong commitment to rely completely, although we couldn't go on alms round, because of the distance to the town. And then in the early days, for several years, just out of concern of waiting until we had our change of use permit to have a monastery, so we didn't we had a legal right to stay there. Then we made that commitment, and still do, where just don't use monastery funds to purchase food. Just rely completely on what is offered, so that when people come to stay, then they'll often bring food and offer it to the kitchen. It stays in the kitchen. Lay people who are visiting anagarikas will help prepare the meal offering, and we're just learning how to be content with what is offered. And it's a really great practice. Because that's where sometimes something as basic as food, I mean, talk about delighting in complication or proliferation. The mind can really crank out fantasies. But just realize, oh no, I really only need whatever sustenance it takes to live for a day and a night. And so in the same way, when coming to a monastic retreat, Anjula Center, just learning how to live simply and realize that you're not in a life-threatening situation. Not getting whatever special food that you're used to it's not life-threatening, and of course in reality, as I said it before the meal, the cooks put a lot of care and attention into trying to really look after us, but also trying to keep it simple, being able to have that quality of contentment, and that's similar for all the other things that come up in terms of the quarters that we have, or the environment that we're in. In an ideal environment for a retreat, there wouldn't be a football game. But it's just sort of, what do you do? To get caught up in that discontent of how things are doesn't mean we have to like it. I never liked football anyway. after 40-odd years of being a monk, it still isn't that interesting to me. But especially when you're sort of breathing in, breathing out. But it's just what it is. It was an impermanent phenomena. It came this morning. It was really good. The hall was incredibly quiet. We're in. The environment that we're in is good enough. This is something that Ajahn Sumedho used to talk about sort of constantly over the years of recognizing that the conditions that we have are good enough for enlightenment. Whether it's the physical conditions, we have a quiet enough environment, we have enough food, we have enough medicines if we get sick, we have enough clothing, we have the kind of accoutrements for our meditation, we've sure got enough cushions in there. And it's good enough. Internally, we all come here with a wholesome intention. We have experience in studying the teachings of the Buddha. We have experience in working with the mind. It's good enough. Is it perfect? Is anything perfect? No. Will it ever be perfect? No. But it's good enough. And to be able to keep returning to that, because they say the nature of desire is always, we always need something else. So that's whether it's on the external level, the cafetiere, it's just not quite good enough. What I realize, an AeroPress. I need an AeroPress. If I had that AeroPress, it would taste so much better. there's always something that is will just make it a little bit better, and it always feels, it's not quite good enough because there's something better. as a practitioner, really learning how to direct our attention to, this is good enough. In the same way that when we sit down to meditate, physically, there's always something that's not quite comfortable, but it's good enough because we can watch the arising and ceasing of discomfort. We can adjust. The Buddha didn't say you have to be sunk in discomfort. But you can adjust, and you can work with physical discomfort, and you have to tune into it a bit to learn. Okay, what's an appropriate adjustment? Because sometimes we have an ideal of I've just got to tough out this pain, and then you end up having to go in for knee surgery or something. That doesn't work. It's good enough. I can learn from it. I can understand it. The mind itself. Just as I was saying this morning, so often we want the mind to be absolutely still. We don't want to have any thoughts in the mind. But that's, it's not really realistic. So Ajahn Chah was asking, which person is it that doesn't have any thoughts at all? And of course, well, must be the Buddha. And it's, no, it must be an Arahant. No, and they ask, well, what is it, Lumpo? It's a dead person. That's who doesn't have any thoughts. So you know, so that you know, that sense of yeah, okay, we have thoughts, we have feelings, we have, it's good enough. We can learn from it. We can understand it. We can see them clearly, and that's where our opportunity for liberation is. That's where our opportunity for peace is. So that yeah, the non-complication, non-proliferation, delighting in that. As a yeah, that's probably be an interesting mantra to work with these 10 days. Good enough. This is good enough. And it really shifts one's attention, because that's certainly not the mantra of modern Western culture, certainly modern American culture. Because that good enough isn't good enough for some years ago the advertising slogan for American Express was, take the waiting out of wanting. So that when you wanted something, when you desired something, when you really, really need this, you could get it without having to go through that good enough. What I've got's good enough. I don't need that. You can skip that. Yeah, just get it. To take the waiting out of wanting. So to direct attention to this quality of good enough, the quality of contentment, and you realize that that's where the mind becomes settled, and say the peace of the mind is not the controlling of it, but the ability to be clear and content within it. So, and during this, monastic retreat, many of the things that we do, the routine, the way it's structured, helps to support a monastic ethos of learning contentment, learning patience, learning. As saying Ajahn Chah, so often we'd go to him and with our meditation problems, our spiritual difficulties, want him to solve it for us. And so often, he'd listen and say, just be patient. just learning how to be patient, be present with what we're experiencing. You realize, oh, with that thing, there's a change that takes place. Mm-hmm. That sense of oh, I can be one of few wishes. I can be one who's content. I can be one who is fine with being on my own. I don't have to seek out company. I can put forth some effort. I can fine-tune that mindfulness. I can center, I can settle the mind. And I can cultivate discernment. And I can delight in non-complication. I can delight in non-proliferation. That these ways of directing our thought processes and that they get directed because we see the value in it. Of course, this is something that a monastic retreat is. And we're not pounding it over people's heads, so we probably won't say much about it after this. But it's to pay attention in the daily rhythm, things that you can learn from. Pay attention in the ways that things are done, and both how we ourselves as the monastic community that's here, and the routines we set, different encouragements that we've given, recognize how that can support that inclining and delighting in Dhamma. So I'll offer that for reflection this afternoon.
Om Namayam Dhamma Kataya Kam Jadama Se Sa